Hello everyone, my name is Elijah David, minister of the 12th hour of Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation. Now it's not the 12th hour, the day is September the 28th, 2025, or it is the 8th day of Tishri, 2029. We will do our first service today from Patriarchs and Prophets, on chapter 19. The return to Canaan is a return to Canaan by Jacob and his people. Crossing the Jordan, Jacob came in peace unto the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. Genesis 33:38. Thus the patriarch's prayer at Bethel, and Yahweh that Yahweh would bring him again in peace to his own land had been granted. For a time he dwelt in the vale of Shechem. It was here that Abraham, more than 100 years before, had made his first encampment and erected his first altar in the land of promise. Here Jacob bought the parcel of ground where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money, and he created there an altar and called it El Shiloh Israel. Verse 19, 20. For the Yahweh of Israel, like Abraham, Jacob set up beside his tent an altar unto the Yahweh, calling the members of his household to the morning and evening sacrifice. It was here also that he dug the well, under which 17 centuries later came Jacob's sons and Savior, and besides which resting during the noontide heat, he told his wandering hearers of that well of water springing up unto everlasting life. John 4:14. The tarry of Jacob and his sons at Shechem ended in violence and bloodshed. The one daughter of the household had been brought to shame and sorrow. Two brothers were involved in the guilt of murder. A whole city had been given to ruin and slaughter in retaliation for the lawless deed of the one rash youth. The beginning that led to results so terrible was the act of Jacob's daughter, who went out to see the daughters of the land, thus venturing into association with the unrighteous. He who seeks pleasure among those that fear not Yahweh is placing himself on Satan's ground and inviting his temptation. The treacherous cruelty of Simon and Levi was not unprovoked. Yet in their course toward the Shechemites, they committed a grievous sin. they had carefully concealed from Jacob their intentions, and the tidings of their revenge filled him with horror, heartsick at the deceit and violence of his son. He only said, "You have troubled me to make me distinct among the inhabitants of the land, and I, being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house." But the grief and abhorrence with which he rewarded their bloody deed is shown by the words in which nearly 50 years later he referred to it as he lay upon his deathbed in Egypt. Simeon and Levi are brethren, instruments of cruelty are in their habitation. O my soul, come not thou into their secret, unto their assembly. Mine honor, be not thou united. Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel. Genesis 49:5-7. Jacob felt that there was cause for the deep humiliation, cruelty, and falsehood for manifesting the character of his son. There were false gods in the camp, and idolatry had to some extent gained a foothold even in his household. Should Yahweh deal with them according unto their deserts, would he not lead them to the vengeance of the surrounding nation? While Jacob was thus bowed down with trouble, the Yahweh directed him to journey southward to Bethel. The thought of this place reminded the patriarch not only of his vision of the angel and of Yahweh's promises of mercy, but also of the vow which he had made there, that Yahweh should be his Yahweh, for he determined that, before going to this sacred spot, his household should be freed from the defilement of idolatry. He therefore gave direction to all in the antenna, put away the strange gods that are among you, and be clean and change your garments, and let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make there an altar unto Yahweh, who answered me in the day of my distress, and was with me in the way which I went. With a deep emotion, Jacob repeated the story of his first visit to Bethel, when he left his father's tent a lonely wanderer, fleeing for his life, and how the Yahweh had appeared to him in the night vision. As he reviewed the wonderful deeds of Yahweh with him, his own heart was softened. His children also were touched by a subduing power. He had taken the most effectual way to prepare them to join in the worship of Yahweh when they should arrive at Bethel. and they gave her to Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hands, and all their earrings which were in their ears. And Jacob had hid them under the oak which was by Shechem. Let's read that again. And they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hand, and all their earrings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the oak which was by Shechem. Yahweh caused a fear to rest upon the inhabitants of the land, so that they made no attempt to avenge the slaughter of Shechem. The travelers reached Bethel unmolested. Here the Yahweh again appeared unto Jacob and renewed unto him the covenant promise. And Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, even a pillar of stone. At Bethel Jacob was called to mourn the loss of one who had long been an honored member of the father's family, Rebekah's nurse, Deborah, who had accompanied her mistress from Mesopotamia to the land of Canaan. For the presence of this aged woman had been to Jacob a precious tie that bound him to his early life, and especially to the mother whose love for him had been so strong and tender. For the Deborah was buried with the expressions of so great sorrow that the oak under which her grave was made was called the Oak of Weeping. It should not be passed unnoticed that the memory of her life, of the faithful service, and of the mourning over this household friend has been accounted worthy to be preserved in the word of Yahweh. From Bethel it was only a 2 days' journey to Hebron, but it brought to Jacob a heavy grief in the death of Rachel. Twice 7 years service he had rendered for her sake, and his love had made the toil but light. How deep and abiding that love had been was shown when long after the Jacob in Egypt lay near his death, Joseph came to visit his father, and the aged patriarch, glancing back upon his own life, said, "As for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died by me in the land of Canaan, in the way, when yet there was but a little way to come unto Ephrath, and I buried her there in the way of Ephrath." Genesis 48:7. In the family history of his long and troubled life, the loss of Rachel was alone recalled. Before her death, Rachel gave birth to a second son. With her parting breath, she named the child Benoni, a son of my sorrow. But his father called him Benjamin, son of my right hand, or my strength. Rachel was buried where she died, and a pillar was raised upon the spot to perpetuate her memory. On the way to Ephrath, another dark crime stained the family of Jacob, causing Reuben, the firstborn son, to be denied the privileges and honors of the birthright. At last, Jacob came to his journey's end, and to Isaac his father. Unto Mamre, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned. Here he remained during the closing years of his father's life. And Isaac, infirm and blind, the kind attentions of this long absent son were a comfort during the years of loneliness and bereavement. Jacob and Esau met at the deathbed of their father. Once the older brother had looked forward to this event as an opportunity for the revenge. But his feeling has since greatly changed, and Jacob, well content with the spiritual blessings of the birthright, resigned to the elder brother the inheritance of their father's wealth. The only inheritance that Esau sought or valued. They were no longer estranged by jealousy or hatred. Yet they parted, Esau removing to Mount Seir. Yahweh, who is rich in blessing, had granted to Jacob worldly wealth in addition to the higher good that he had sought. For the possessions of the two brothers were more than that they might dwell together, and the land wherein they were strangers could not bear them because of their cattle. This separation was in accordance with the divine purpose. Concerning Jacob, since the brothers differed so greatly in regard to the religious faith, it was better for them to dwell apart. Esau and Jacob had alike been instructed in the knowledge of Yahweh, and both were free to walk in his commandments and to receive his favor. But they had not both chosen to do this, for the two brothers had walked in the different ways, and their paths would continue to diverge more and more widely. There was no arbitrary choice on the part of Yahweh by which Esau was shut out from the blessings of the salvation, for the gifts of his grace through Yahshua are free unto all. There is no election but one's own, by which any may perish. Yahweh has set forth in his word the conditions upon which every soul will be elected to eternal life. Obedience to his commandments through the faith in Yahshua. Yahweh has elected a character in harmony with his law, and anyone who shall reach the standard of his requirement will have an entrance into the kingdom of glory. Yahshua himself said, "He that believeth on the Son hath not everlasting life, and he that believeth not the Son shall not see life." John 3:36. Not everyone that saith unto me, Yahshua, Yahweh, Yahweh, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven. But he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. Matthew 7:21. And in the Revelation he declared, Blessed are they that do his commandments, that they may have right to the tree of life and may enter in through the gates into the city. Revelation 22:14. As regards man's final salvation, this is the only election brought to view in the Word of Yahweh. Every soul is elected who will work out his own salvation with a fear and trembling. He is elected who will put on the armor and fight the good fight of the faith. He is elected who will watch unto prayer, who will search the scriptures and flee from temptation. He is elected who will have faith continually and who will be obedient unto every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of Yahweh. The provisions of the redemption are free to all. The results of the redemption will be enjoyed by those who have complied with the condition. Esau had despised the blessing of the covenant. He had valued temporal above spiritual good, and he had received that which he deserved. It was by his own deliberate choice that he was separated from the people of Yahweh. Jacob had chosen the inheritance of the faith. He had endeavored to obtain it by craft, treachery, and falsehood. But Yahweh had permitted his sin to work out its correction. Yet through all the bitter experience of his latter years, Jacob had never swerved from his purpose or renounced his choice. He had learned that in resorting to the human skill and craft to secure the blessing, he had been warned against Yahweh. From the night of the wrestling beside the Jabbok, Jacob had come forth a different man. Self-confidence had been uprooted. Henceforth, the early cunning was no longer seen. In a place of craft and deception, his life was marked by simplicity and truth. He had learned the lessons of the simple reliance upon the Almighty Arm, and amid the trial and affliction, he bowed in the humble submission to the will of Yahweh. The baser elements of the character were consumed in a furnace fire. The true gold was refined until the faith of Abraham and Isaac appeared undimmed in Jacob. For the sin of Jacob and the train of events under which it led had not failed to exert an influence for evil, an influence that revealed his latter trait in the character and life of his son. As these sons arrived at manhood, they developed serious faults, the results of polygamy were manifest in the household. This terrible evil tends to dry up the very springs of love, and its influence weakens the most sacred tie. The jealousy of the several mothers had embittered the family relation. The children had grown up contentious and impatient of control, and the father's life was darkened with anxiety and grief. There was one, however, of a widely different character. The elder son of Rachel, Joseph, whose rare personal beauty has seemed but to reflect an inward beauty of mind and heart, pure, active, and joyous. The lad gave evidence also of moral earnestness and firmness. He listened to his father's instruction and left to obey Yahweh, the quality that afterwards distinguished him in Egypt: gentleness, fidelity, and truthfulness. Were already steadfast in his daily life. His mother being dead, his affection clung the more closely to the father, and Jacob's heart was bound up in this child at his old age. He loved Joseph more than all his children. But even this affection was to become a cause of trouble and sorrow, for Jacob unwisely manifested his preference for Joseph, and this excited the jealousy of his other sons. So Joseph witnessed the evil conduct of his brother. He was greatly troubled. He ventured gently to remonstrate with them, but only aroused still further their hatred and resentment. He could not endure to see them sinning against Yahweh, and he laid the matter before his father, hoping that his authority might lead them to reform. For Jacob carefully avoided exciting their anger by the harshness or severity. With a deep emotion, he expressed his solicitude for his children and implored them to have respect for his gray hairs and not to bring reproach upon his name, and above all, not to dishonor Yahweh by such disregard of his precepts. For a shame that their wickedness was known, the young men seemed to be repentant, but they only concealed their real feelings, which were rendered more bitter by their this exposure. For the father's injurious gift to Joseph of a cloth of coat of tunic, such as was usually worn by persons of distinction, seemed to them another evidence of his partiality, excited a suspicion that he intended to pass by his elder children to bestow the birthright upon the son of Rachel. Their malice was still further increased as a boy one day told them of a dream that he had had. "Behold," he said, "we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose, and also stood upright. And behold, your shoes stood round about and made obeisance to my shoe. Shalt thou indeed reign over us, or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us? Exclaimed his brothers in the envious anger. Saying he had another dream of a similar import, which he also related. Behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obedience to me. This dream was interpreted as readily as the first. The father who was present spoke reprovingly. What is this dream that thou hast really dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves unto thee to the earth? Notwithstanding the apparent severity of his words, Jacob believed that the Yahweh was revealing the future to Joseph. As the lad stood before his brother, his beautiful countenance lighted up with the spirit of inspiration, they could not withhold their admiration, as they did not choose to renounce their evil ways. And they had the purity that reproved their sin. The same spirit that actuated Cain was kindled in their hearts. The brothers were obliged to move from place to place to secure pasture for their flocks, and frequently they were absent from home for months together. After the circumstances just related, they went to the place which their father had bought at Shechem. Some time passed, bringing no tidings from them, and their father began to fear for their safety on account of their former cruelty toward the Shechemites. He therefore sent Joseph to find them and bring them word as to their welfare. Had Jacob known the real feeling of his sons toward Joseph, he would not have trusted him alone with them. But this they had carefully concealed. With a joyful heart, Joseph parted from his father. Neither the aged man nor the youth dreaming of what would happen before they should meet again. When after his long and solitary journey, Joseph arrived at Shechem. His brothers and their flocks were not to be found. Upon inquiring for them, he was directed to Dothan. He had already traveled more than 50 miles, and now an additional distance of 15 lay before him. But he hastened on, forgetting his weariness and the thought of relieving the anxiety of his father and meeting the brothers, whom, despite their unkindness, he still loved. For his brothers saw him approaching, but no thought of the long journey he had made to meet them. Of his weariness and hunger, of his claims upon their hospitality and brotherly love softened the bitterness of their hatred. For the sight of the coat, the token of their father's love, filled them with frenzy. "Behold, this dreamer cometh," they cried in mockery. Envy and revenge, long secretly cherished, now control them. "Let us slay him," they said, "and cast him into some pit, and we will say, some evil beast has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dream." They would have executed their purpose, but for Reuben. He shrank from participating in the murder of his brother, and purposed that Joseph be cast alive into a pit and left there to perish secretly, intending, however, to rescue him and return him to his father. Having persuaded all to consent to this plan, Reuben left the company, fearing that he might fail to control his feelings and that his real intention would be discovered. Joseph came on unsuspicious of the danger and glad that the object of his long search was accomplished, but instead of the expected greeting, he was terrified by the anger and revengeful glances which he met. He was seized and his coat stripped from him. Taunts and threats revealed a deadly purpose. His entreaties were unheeded. He was wholly in the power of those maddened men, rudely dragging him to a deep pit. They thrust him in, and having made sure that there was no possibility of his escape, they left him there to perish from hunger while they sat down to eat bread. But some of them were ill at ease. They did not feel the satisfaction they had anticipated from their revenge. Soon a company of travelers was seen approaching. It was a caravan of Ishmaelites from beyond Jordan on their way to Egypt for spices and other merchandise. Judah now proposed to sell their brother to these heathen traitors instead of having him to die, while he would be effectually put out of their way, they would remain clear of his blood. "For he urged, he is our brother in our flesh." To this proposition, all agreed, and Joseph was quickly drawn out of the pit. As he saw the merchants, the dreadful truth flashed upon him. To become a slave was a fate more to be feared than death. In an agony of terror, he appealed to one and another of his brothers. But in vain, some were moved with pity, but fear of derision kept them silent. All felt that they had now gone too far to retreat. If Joseph were spared, he would doubtless report them to the father, who would not overlook their cruelty toward his favorite son. Stirring their hearts against his entreaties, or stealing their hearts against his entreaties, they delivered him into the hands of the heathen traders. The caravan moved on and was soon lost to view. Reuben returned to the pit, but Joseph was not there. In alarm and self-reproach, he rent his garments and saw his brothers exclaiming, "The child is not, and I, whither shall I go?" Upon learning the fate of Joseph, and that it would now be impossible to recover him, Reuben was induced to unite with the rest in the attempt to conceal their guilt. Having killed a kid, they dipped Joseph's coat in his blood and took it to their father, telling him that they had found it in the field and that they feared it was their brother. Now they said, "Whether it be thy son's coat or no." They had looked forward to the scene with the dread, but they were not prepared for the heart-rending anguish, the utter abandonment of grief, which they were compelled to witness. "It is my son's coat," said Jacob. "An evil beast hath devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces." Vainly his sons and daughters attempted to comfort him. He rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days. Time seemed to bring no alleviation of his grief. "I will go down into the grave unto my son's mourning," was his despairing cry. The young men, terrified at what they had done, yet dreading their father's reproaches, still had in their own hearts the knowledge of their guilt, which even to themselves seemed very great. This is the end of chapter 19. And now chapter 20, where the title is Joseph in Egypt. And this chapter is based on Genesis 39-41. Meanwhile, Joseph with his captors was on the way to Egypt. As the caravan journeyed southward toward the borders of Canaan, the boy could discern in the distance the hills among which lay his father's tent. Bitterly he wept at the thought of that loving father and his loneliness and affliction. Again, the scene of Dothan came up before him. He saw his angry brothers and felt their fierce glances bent upon him, for the stinging, insulting words that had met his agonized entreaties were ringing in his ears. With a trembling heart, he looked forward to the future. What a change in the situation, from the tenderly cherished son to the despised and helpless slave, alone and friendless. What would be his lot in the strange land under which he was going? For a time Joseph gave himself up to the uncontrolled grief and terror. But in the providence of Yahweh, even this experience was to be a blessing to him. He had learned in a few hours that which years might not otherwise have taught him. His father, strong and tender as his love had been, had done him wrong by his partiality and indulgence. This unwise preference had angered his brothers and provoked them to the cruelties that had separated him from his home. Its effects were manifest also in his own character. Faults had been encouraged that were now to be corrected. He was becoming self-sufficient and exacting. accustomed to the tenderness of his father's cheer, he felt that he was unprepared to cope with the difficulty before him, and the bitter, uncared for life of a stranger and a slave. Then his thoughts turned to his father's Yahweh. In his childhood he had been taught to love and fear him. Often in his father's tent, he had listened to the story of the vision that Jacob saw as he fled from his home, an exile and a fugitive. He had been told of the Yahweh's promises to Jacob and how they had been fulfilled. How in the hour of need, the angels of Yahweh had come to instruct, comfort, and protect him, and he had learned of the love of Yahweh in the providing for men a redeemer. Now all these precious lessons came vividly before him. Joseph believed that the Yahweh of his father would be his Yahweh. He then and there gave himself fully to the Yahweh, and he prayed that the keeper of Israel would be with him in the land of his exile. His soul thrilled with the high resolve to prove himself true to Yahweh under all circumstances, to act became a subject of the King of Heaven. He would serve the Yahweh with undivided heart. He would meet the trials of his lot with fortitude and perform every duty with fidelity. One day's experience had been the turning point in Joseph's life. His terrible calamity had transformed him from a pitted child to a man thoughtful, courageous, and self-possessed. Arriving in Egypt, Joseph was sold to Potiphar, captain of the king's guard, in whose service he remained for 10 years. He was here exposed to temptations of no ordinary character. He was in the midst of idolatry. The worship of false gods was surrounded by all the pomp of royalty, supported by the wealth and culture of the most highly civilized nation then in existence. Yet Joseph preserved the simplicity and his fidelity to Yahweh. The sights and sounds of vice were all about him, but he was as one who saw and heard not. His thoughts were not permitted to linger upon forbidden subjects. The desire to gain the favor of the Egyptian could not cause him to conceal his principle. Had he attempted to do this, he would have been overcome by the temptation, but he was not ashamed of the religion of his father, and he made no effort to hide the fact that he was a worshiper of the Yahweh. And the Yahweh was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man. And his master saw that the Yahweh was with him, and that the Yahweh made all that he did to prosper in his hand. Potiphar's confidence in Joseph increased daily, and he finally promised him to be his steward with the full control over all his possessions. And he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he knew not aught he had, save the bread which he did eat. And the marked prosperity which attended everything placed under Joseph's care was not the result of a direct miracle, but his industry, care, and energy were crowned with a divine blessing. Joseph attributed his success to the favor of Yahweh, and even his idolatrous master accepted this as a secret of his unparalleled prosperity. Without steadfast, well-directed effort, however, success could never have been attained. Yahweh was glorified by the faithfulness of his servant. It was his purpose that in purity and uprightness, the believer in Yahweh should appear in a marked contrast to the worshippers of idols. That thus the light of the heavenly grace might shine forth amid the darkness of heathenism. Joseph's gentleness and fidelity won the heart of the chief captain, who came to regard him as a son rather than a slave. For the youth was brought in contact with men of rank and learning, and he acquired a knowledge of science, of languages, and of affairs, an education needful for the future prime minister of Egypt. But Joseph's faith and integrity were to be tested by the fiery trials his master's wife endeavored to entice the young man to transgress the law of Yahweh. Hitherto, for he had remained untainted by the corruption teeming in the heathen land. But this temptation, so sudden, so strong, so seductive, how should it be met? Joseph knew well what would be the consequence of resistance. On the one hand, were concealment, favor, and rewards. On the other, disgrace, imprisonment, perhaps death. His whole future life depended upon the decision of the moment. Would principle triumph? Would Joseph still be true to Yahweh? With inexpressible anxiety, angels looked upon the scene. Joseph's answer revealed the power of religions, of the religious principle. He would not betray the confidence of his master on earth. And whatever the consequences, he would be true to his master in heaven. Under the inspecting eye of Yahweh and the holy angel, many take liberties of which they would not be guilty in the presence of their fellow men. But Joseph's first thought was of Yahweh. How can I do this great wickedness and sin against Yahweh, he said. If we were to cherish an habitual impression that Yahweh say and hears all that we do, and say and keeps a faithful record of our words and action, and that we must meet it all, we would fear to sin. Let the young ever remember that whenever they are, wherever they are, and whatever they do, they are in the presence of Yahweh. No part of our conduct escapes observation. We cannot hide our ways from the Most High. Human laws, though sometimes severe, are often transgressed without detection, and hence with impunity, but not so with the law of Yahweh. The deepest midnight is no cover for the guilty one. He may think himself alone, but under every deed there is an unseen witness, for the very motives of his heart are open to the divine inspection. Every act, every word, every thought is as distinctly marked as though there were only one person in the whole world, and attention of heaven were centered upon him, Joseph suffered for his integrity, for his tempter revenged himself by accusing him of a foul crime and causing him to be thrust into prison. Had Potiphar believed his wife's charge against Joseph, the young Hebrew would have lost his life. But the modesty and uprightness that had uniformly characterized his conduct were proof of his innocence. And yet, to save the reputation of his master's house, he was abandoned to disgrace and bondage. At the first, Joseph was treated with great severity by his jailer. The psalmist said, "His feet, they hurt with fetters. He was laid in the chains of iron until the time that his word came to pass, the word of the Yahweh tried him." Psalms 105:18-19. But Joseph's real character shines out, even in the darkness of the dungeon. He held fast his faith and patience. His years of the faithful service had been most cruelly repaid. Yet this did not render him morose or distrustful. He had the peace that comes from the conscious innocence, and he trusted his case with Yahweh. He did not brood upon his own wrongs, but forgot his sorrow and trying to lighten the sorrows of others. He found a work to do, even in the prison. Yahweh was preparing him in the school of affliction for the greater usefulness, and he did not refuse the need for discipline. In the prison, witnessing the results of the oppression and tyranny and the effects of crime, he learned lessons of justice, sympathy, and mercy that prepared him to exercise power with wisdom and compassion. Joseph gradually gained the confidence of the keeper of the prison and was finally entrusted with the charge of all the prisoners. It was a part he acted in the prison for the integrity of his daily life and his sympathy for those who were in trouble and distress that opened the way for his future prosperity and honor. Every ray of the light that we shed upon others is reflected upon ourselves. Every kind and sympathizing word spoken to the sorrowful mercy act to relieve the oppressed, and every gift to the needy, if prompted by a right motive, will result in the blessings to the giver. For the chief baker and chief butler of the king had been cast into prison for some offense, and they came under Joseph's charge. One morning, observing that they appeared very sad, he kindly inquired the cause and was told that each had had a remarkable dream, of which they were anxious to learn the significance. "Do not interpretations belong to Yahweh?" said Joseph. Tell me them, I pray you." As each related his dream, Joseph made known its import. In 3 days, the butler was to be reinstated in his position and give the cup into Pharaoh's hand as before. But the chief baker would be put to death by the king's command. In both cases, the event occurred as foretold. The king's cupbearer had professed the deepest gratitude to Joseph, both for the cheering interpretation of his dream and for the many acts of the kind attention, and in return the latter referring in a most touching manner to his own unjust captivity, and entreated that his case be brought before the king. Think on me, he said, when it shall be well with thee, and show kindness, I pray thee, unto me, and make mention of me unto Pharaoh, and bring me out of this house. For indeed I was stolen away out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also have I done nothing that they should put me into the dungeon. The chief butler saw the dream fulfilled in every particular, but when restored to royal favor, he thought no more of his benefactor. For 2 years longer, Joseph remained a prisoner. The hope that had been kindled in his heart gradually died out, and unto all other trials was added the bitter sting of ingratitude. But a divine hand was about to open the prison gates, for the king of Egypt had in one night 2 dreams, apparently pointing to the same event, and seeming to foreshadow some great calamity. For he could not determine then their significance, yet they continued to trouble his mind. For the magicians and wise men of his realm could give no interpretation, for the king's perplexity and distress increased, and terror spread throughout his palace. For the general agitation recalled to the chief butler's mind the circumstances of his own dream, when it came the memory of Joseph. With it came the memory of Joseph and a pang of remorse for his forgetfulness and ingratitude. He at once informed the king how his own dream and that of the chief baker had been interpreted by a Hebrew captive, and how the predictions had been fulfilled. It was humiliating to Pharaoh to turn away from the magician. And wise men of his kingdom to consult an alien and a slave, that he was ready to accept the lowliest service if his troubled mind might find relief. Joseph was immediately sent for. He put off his prison attire and shaved himself, for his hair had grown long during the period of his disgrace and confinement. He was then conducted to the presence of the king, and Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I have dreamed a dream, and there is none that can interpret it, and I have heard say of thee that thou canst understand a dream to interpret it. And Joseph answers Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me. Yahweh shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace. Joseph replied to the king, reveals his humility and his faith in Yahweh. He modestly disclaimed the honor of the possessing in himself super wisdom. It is not in me. Yahweh alone can explain these mysteries. Pharaoh then proceeded to relate his dream. Behold, I stood upon the bank of the river, and behold, there came up out of the river 7 kine, fat fleshed and well favored, and they fed in a meadow. And behold, 7 other kine came up after them, poor and very ill-favored and lean flesh, such as I never saw in all the land of Egypt for badly. And the lean and the ill-favored kine did eat up the first seven fat kine, and when they had eaten them up, it could not be known that they had eaten them, but they were still ill-favored as at the beginning. So I awoke, and I saw in my dream, and behold, seven ears came up in the one stalk, full and good. And behold, seven ears withered, thin and blasted, which the east wind sprung up after them. And the thin ears devoured their seven good ears. And I told this unto the magician, but there was none that could declare it to me. The dream of Pharaoh is one, said Joseph. Yahweh has showed Pharaoh what he is about to do. There were to be 7 years of great plenty. Field and garden would yield more abundantly than ever before, and this period was to be followed by 7 years of famine, and the plenty shall not be known in the land by reason of that famine following, for it shall be very grievous, for the repetition of the dream was evidence both of the certainty and the nearness of the fulfillment. Now therefore, he continued, let Pharaoh look out a man discreet and wise, and set him over the land of Egypt, that Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint officers over the land, and take up the fifth part of the land of Egypt in the seven plenteous years, and let them gather all the food of those good years that come, and lay up corn under the hand of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the city, and that food shall be for store for the land against the 7 years of the famine. For the interpretation was so reasonable and consistent, and the policy which it recommended was so sound and shrewd, that its correctness could not be doubted. But who was to be entrusted with the execution of the plan? Upon the wisdom of this choice depended the nations for preservation. The king was troubled. For some time, the matter of the appointment was under consideration, through the chief butler. The monarch had learned of the wisdom and prudence displayed by Joseph in the management of the prison. It was evident that he possessed administrative ability in a preeminent degree. The cupbearer now fell with a self-reproach, endeavored to atone for his former ingratitude by the warmest praise of his benefactor, and further inquiry by the king proved the correctness of his report. In all the realm, Joseph was as the only man gifted with the wisdom to point out the danger that threatened the kingdom and the preparation necessary to meet it. And the king was convinced that he was the one best qualified to execute the plan which he had purposed. It was evident that a divine power was with him, and that there were none among the king's officers of the state so well qualified to conduct the affairs of the nation at this crisis. The fact that he was a Hebrew and a slave was of little moment when weighed against his evident wisdom and sound judgment. Can we find such a one as this is? A man in whom the Spirit of Yahweh is, said the king to his counselors. for the appointment was decided upon after Joseph. The astonishing announcement was made. Forasmuch as Yahweh has showed thee all this, there is none so discreet and wise as thou art. Thou shalt be over my house, and according unto thy word shall all my people be ruled. Only in the throne will I be greater than thou. For the king proceeded to invest Joseph with the insignia of his high office. And Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand and put it upon Joseph's hand, and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen, and put a gold chain about his neck, and he made him to ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried before him, bow the knee. He made him lord of his house and ruler of all his substance, to bind his princes at his pleasure and teach his senators wisdom. Psalms 105:21-22. From the dungeon Joseph was exalted to be a ruler over all the land of Egypt. It was a position of high honor, yet it was beset with difficulty and peril. One cannot stand upon a lofty height without danger. As the tempest leaves unharmed the lowly flower of the valley, while it uproots the stately tree up on the mountaintop, so those who have maintained their integrity in the humble life may be dragged down to the pit by the temptations that assailed their worldly success and honor. But Joseph's character bore the test alike of adversity and prosperity. For the same fidelity to Yahweh was manifest when he stood in the palace of the Pharaohs, as when in a prisoner's cell he was still a stranger in a heathen land. Separated from his kindred, the worshippers of Yahweh, but he fully believed that the divine hand had directed his steps, and in constant reliance upon Yahweh, he faithfully discharged the duties of his position. Through Joseph, the attention of the king had a great man of Egypt was directed to the true Yahweh, and though they adhered to their idolatry, they learned to respect the principles revealed in the life and character of the worshiper of Joseph, of the Yahweh. How was Joseph enabled to make such a record of the firmness of character, uprightness, and wisdom? In the early years, he had consulted the duty rather than inclination, and the integrity, the simple trust, the noble nature of the youth bear fruit, and the deeds of the man. A pure and simple life has favored the vigorous development of both physical and intellectual power. Communion with the Yahweh through his work and the contemplation of the grand truth entrusted to the inheritors of faith has elevated and ennobled his spiritual nature, broadening and strengthening the mind as no other study could do. Faithful attention to duty at every station, from the lowliest to the most exalted, has been training every power for his highest service. He who lives in accordance with the Creator will be securing to himself assurance and notice development of his heritage. For the fear of the Yahweh, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. Job 28:28. There are few who realize the influence of the little things of life upon the development of the church. Nothing with which we have to do is really small. For the very circumstances that we meet day by day are designed to test our faithfulness and to qualify us for the greater trust by the adherence unto the principles and the transactions of the ordinary life. The mind becomes accustomed to hold the claims of duty above those of pleasure and inclination. Minds thus disciplined are not wavering between right and wrong. Like the reed trembling in the wind, they are loyal to duty because they have trained themselves to habits of fidelity and truth. By the faithfulness in that which is least, they acquire strength to be faithful in greater matters. An upright character is of a great worth than the gold of Ophir. Without it, none can rise to an honorable eminence. But character is not inherited. It cannot be bought, moral excellence, and time, mental qualities are not the result of accident. For the most precious gifts are of so value, of no value unless they are improved. For the formation of a noble character is a work of a lifetime, and must be the result of a diligent and persevering effort. Yahweh gives opportunity. Success depends upon the use we made of them. This brings the end of chapter 20, and this is the end of our study this day. We'll close now with a song.